my name is Kevin Featherstone, and I'm the director of the Hellenic Observatory here at the London School of Economics. We're delighted to be hosting this discussion today. The discussion is focused on a new book, one that analyzes the patterns of cultural change that have occurred in Greece since 1974. The period since 1974 is often used as a reference point for exploring change in Greece, especially in terms of political change. Less well explored are the socio-cultural changes and continuities that underpin attitudes towards matters such as identity, antiquity, religion, language, literature, the media, the cinema, youth, gender, and sexuality, etc. This is the terrain of a new book written by our guest this evening, Professor Dimitris Giovas. In his exploration, Professor Giovas puts under the spotlight the concept of modernization. What it is to be modern and the process of achieving modernization are questions that have recurred throughout the historiography and the social scientific study of what we feel obliged to refer to as modern Greece. No other European country requires a distinction in the same way between modern and prior periods. Greece is also a country that has been led by politicians identifying themselves as modernizers, both in the 19th century, but also in the more recent past. So both theorists and politicians have found a utility in the term modern. The book explores the notions of modernity and of dependence, of westernized and pre-modern contrasts, of the intellectual utility of explaining history through dualisms. Professor Giovas sees the post-1974 period as one of the most pluralistic and diverse periods in modern Greek history. And he explores not dualisms, but hybrid tensions and cultural ambivalences. The subtitle of the book alerts us to modernization as aspiration, transition as process, and diversity as outcomes. A focus on and the conflicts over identity define the transition since 1974. Let me say immediately, I found the book to be very well written and authoritative in its commentary on the many lenses that we might have on cultural change in Greece. It should be of interest to many readers from a range of academic fields. And you'll be seeing on your screen, not only the book cover here, but later how you can purchase the book at a discount. I strongly recommend it to you. So let's explore the book more deeply. Let me introduce our speakers. Dimitris Giovas is Professor of Modern Greek Studies at the University of Birmingham. He is a highly respected analyst of the cultural politics of Greece. Indeed, he has written a number of books that are directly relevant to today's topic, notably The Other Self, Selfhood and Society in Modern Greek Fiction in 2003, Greece from Junta to Crisis, Modernization, Transition, and Diversity. And he edited Reimagining the Past, Greek Antiquity and Modern Greek Culture in 2014, and Greece in Crisis, The Cultural Politics of Austerity. He's published a number of books in Greek and also newspaper articles in Greece. And we're very fortunate to have two other leading academics to discuss Dimitris's new book. Both will be very well known to Greek audiences. Thalia Dragonas is Professor Emerita of Social Psychology at the National and Kapodistrian University of Athens, having previously served as Dean of its School of Education. Her writings have focused on issues of minorities, refugee integration, psychosocial identities, intergroup relations, social inclusion, intercultural education, ethnocentrism, prevention and promotion of early psychosocial health. As well as being an academic, she has served as a Member of Parliament with BASOC and was special secretary at the Greek Ministry of Education on educational planning and intercultural education. Stathis Kalibas is Gladstone Professor of Government in the Department of Politics and International Relations at the University of Oxford and a Fellow of All Souls College. Until 2018, he was Arnold Wolfe's Professor of Political Science at Yale University, where he founded and directed the Program on Order, Conflict and Violence and co-directed the Hellenic Studies Program. He's written extensively on civil wars, ethnicity and political violence. His current research focuses on global trends in political violence and conflict. He's written many well-received books on the history and politics of Greece, and indeed has recently fronted his own TV history of modern Greece on Sky Television, which has been very well received. We've arranged that Dimitris Tsiovas will speak for about the first 25 minutes, and then we'll pass to Thalia and Stathis for about 10 minutes each. We invite you, the audience, to send us your questions. If you're watching us using the Zoom facility, you can use the Q&A function at the bottom of your screens. If you're following this live on Facebook, then please use the comment facility to send us your questions. As your chair, can I please ask you to keep the questions short so we can get through as many as possible, and tell us your name and any affiliation. We also invite you as the audience to send us your comments on Twitter, and we suggest the hashtag LCGreece. We're recording today's event, and we hope, barring any technical problem, to make this available as a podcast for downloading. So we can look forward to a very interesting discussion on an important new book, and we pass to its author, Professor Dimitris Tsiovas.
Good afternoon. First of all, I would like to thank the Hellenic Observatory and Kevin in particular for the invitation to present my book. I should also thank the two discussants for taking part in this event and offering their comments. A book in English on post-Junta Greece was long overdue, as has become increasingly apparent to me during my long teaching career at the University of Birmingham. After the completion of my HRC project on the crisis and editing the volume Greece in Crisis, the Cultural Politics of Austerity, published in 2017, and Kevin mentioned that, I decided that the time had come to attempt such an interdisciplinary project using two watershed events in Greek history, the fall of the military junta and the economic crisis to bookend it. The task was made easier by a two-year Leverhulme Fellowship. Obviously, the book does not aspire to offer comprehensive coverage of developments in Greece after 1974, but simply aims to explore certain important areas, deploying a cultural perspective and using three key concepts as connecting threads in the analysis: modernization, transition, and diversity. I plan to offer you a brief introduction to the book, which could be described as a kind of cultural history of post-1974 Greece. The period following the fall of the military junta in 1974 could be described as a Swiss phase of Greek history, known as the Metapolitευση, meaning regime change, referring both to the transition from dictatorship to democracy and to the ensuing period, but with no agreement as to its duration. It changed the political landscape of Greece and led to the country's longest period of peace and prosperity. It also contributed to the reconciliation of warring factions in Greek society, with the legalization of the Communist Party and the return of political refugees, and paved the way to consensus on the abolition of the monarchy in 1974, the language question in 1976, and membership of the European Club in 1981. A period of high expectations, dynamism, and mobility was inaugurated, and Greece gradually developed into a tolerant society. The restoration of democracy challenged the post-Civil War ideological status quo by replacing anti-communism with anti-fascism as the country's foundational myth, the nation, ethnos, with the people, laos, ethnico-frotisini, roughly translated as patriotism, with Ellinikota Romiosini translated as Greekness, and the promotion of democratic values. If the metapolitefsi can be described in political terms as an age of democratization and reconciliation, in cultural terms, it might be defined as the age of identities, since its main preoccupations, Europeanization, contested pasts, religion, migration, language, gender, converge from different pathways on the notion of identity as a common denominator. And this backs up the claim that culture has always been ahead of political or institutional initiatives in rehabilitating or promoting the other, the marginal, or the neglected in various cultural discourses and art forms. How then should we define or periodize the metapolitefsi? When does it end? And is it a useful term? These questions have been discussed for years, and while the term itself is still shrouded in vagueness, there are definitely two main approaches to the metapolitefsi. The politico-historical one, which tends to focus on outlining its various phases or speculating about its end, and the evaluative, which is retrospective and totalizing in assessing the period as a whole. As with a post-war period, most historians tend to delimit the beginning, but not the end of the era. And panic statements such as, let's put an end to the metapolitefsi, show an eagerness for closure. It is worth noting that similar pronouncements have been made ever since the mid-1980s. Later on, historians were keen to place the end firmly in 1989, which they justified by citing the rise of individualism and the receding of the political as a social ideal, as well as the fall of the end of the Cold War. While others saw the start of the economic crisis as decisively marking its end and the threshold to the 21st century. On the one hand, the metapolitefsi has been praised as a period of prosperity, democratization, peace, and improved access to health and education, while on the other, it has been criticized for clientelism, failed modernization, state expansion, corruption, and political violence. The crisis strengthened this dual perception of the post-1974 period, both as success and failure, progress and regression. The country's post-1974 history has been turned into an interpretive framework and has often been blamed for the troubled present and the uncertain future. Dependency, underdevelopment, and modernization were key concepts in the metapolitefsi, with the dependency of the late 1970s and early 80s, and modernization, a term loaded with meaning but often lacking in definition, from the mid-1980s onwards, being the two dominant theories for explaining Greece's position in the world. The former involved either the Cold War dynamics and its political divisions, assigning Greece nominally to the West, or the neo-Marxist dependency narrative, placing Greece in the third world or the capitalist periphery, echoing the theories of the American economists Paul Baran and Paul Sweezy and their book Monopoly Capital in 1966. This approach relied mainly on political oppositions and economic considerations without explaining either why Greece was prone to more economic crisis than other OECD or EU partners, or why it developed a decent parliamentary system at an early stage, joined exclusive Western clubs, and was among the top 40 countries in terms of its per capita income. Earlier contributions to the modernization debate by Marxist sociologists adopted the dependency approach and focused primarily on the role of the state. In a paper on tradition and modernization published in 1983, Konstantinos Tsoukalas points out that, I quote, the difference between peripheral and central societies is usually experienced as lack, distortion, and weakness, end of quote. In his view, in Greece, the state has not functioned according to the Weberian criteria of rational bureaucracy, and this constitutes the particularity of the Greek case in contrast to the West. His approach was informed by the neo-Marxist dependency theory, as the title of his study, Dependency and Reproduction, the Social Role of Educational Mechanism in Greece, 1830-1922, suggests. The book was published in Greek, and the title is translation. From another Marxist from Christian Orthodox perspective of the 1970s, Kostismos Hof pointed to the dependency of the Greek state on the West, and particularly the inadequate appropriation of its liberal ideology by the Greek bourgeoisie compradors. By combining Christian Orthodoxy and Marxism, Moskov tried to outline a different pathway for overcoming Western dominance and securing the Greek state's autonomy. Later approaches equated modernization with Europeanization, focusing on institutional, legal, or social policy reform and following EU guidelines. Their focus was not so much on Greece's economic dependency as on catching up with Europe. Modernization coupled with Europeanization and nationalization became the mantra of Kostas Simitis' period of office, 1996-2004, and for his followers. As a one-way process, it involved equating the West with modernity and the efforts of a state with inadequate institutional infrastructure to catch up with the Western model. Being evolutionary, theological, and referring to a number of processes such as industrialization, secularization, democratization, modernization represented an invitation to internalize the need to strive to catch up and invited Greeks to measure themselves against European models or work towards achieving European standards and in turn shed traces of belatedness and underdevelopment. Practices such as locating Greece in the capitalist periphery or judging its performance by European standards were accompanied by debates on cultural dualism. Greece was seen as constantly caught between tradition and modernity, East and West, Orthodoxy and Enlightenment, Byzantium, the Romaic, and Antiquity, the Hellenic, the Reformist, and the underdog culture. One of the best sellers of the Metapolitics was a short book by Nikos Dimou on the unhappiness of being Greek, it is here to Naissa Elements, which was first published soon after the fall of Junta in 1975, and has since then gone through a number of editions, 38 so far, and been translated into English. An excerpt from the postscript of the 2013 edition demonstrates the resilience of the dualist perception of the Greek torn between opposing forces. I quote, "He is divided between his glorious past and his meager present, between his Eastern mentality and his European aspirations, torn asunder by forces of tradition, like the Orthodox Church and modernity. His is a difficult fate." End of quote. The tyranny of dualism seems to trap Greeks into two incompatible identity roles, as both Western responsible and disciplined individuals, an image on display during the first COVID-19 lockdown, and as members of a caring traditional community marked by cultural intimacy and family values. Relying on a comparison with the developed world and an idealized picture of the West, often taken as an undifferentiated entity, modernization points to a series of deviations or absences in Greek society. A middle class, pointed by Kondylis, civil society, pointed by Mouzelis, and individualization, pointed out by Ramphos. Intellectual historians like Kitromilidis, in his book on Greek Enlightenment, ask why did the Enlightenment not lead to the development of a liberal political culture in Greece? The country has been judged according to a Western model and has been found lacking or simply diverging, as the following quotation from a recent article by the anthropologist René Hirschhorn suggests. I quote, "What I call a pre-modern approach or a non-Western one to issues of time management continues to prevail in Greece because Greece did not follow the path of industrialization of the developed countries of the EU," end of quote. By adopting a comparative or dualist approach, the modernization theory treats Greece as a story of inadequacy or belatedness. Belated compared to other Europeans and inferior in respect to their ancient ancestors, Greeks have always been measured and found wanting. In his book, Belated Modernity and Aesthetic Culture, Gregory Giustanis put forward the view that modernization in Greece has been judged imperfect on the assumption that in non-Western societies, belated modernization remains incomplete, not because it deviates from the supposedly correct path, but because it cannot culminate in a faithful duplication of Western prototypes. Modernization theories based on the pattern of the Western model and its inadequate reproduction have been supported by the Western idealization of classical Greece, which also presupposes the comparative difference between the latter and the present day, as well as the Western discontent with the modern country. This could range from disappointment, a falling short of Greece's reputation in the Western imagery, to the consideration of the country as inadequately modern or institutionally inefficient, an image reinforced by the recent crisis. The conflicting symbiosis of these two discourses among Westerners and even Greeks themselves became more visible as a result of the challenges of the EEC-EU partnership membership and received additional impetus during the crisis. Notions of underdevelopment, belatedness, or insufficient modernity formed a negative and pre-modern picture of Greece. Things become further complicated by the fact that Greeks themselves might either be complicit in this blaming and self-orientalizing process, or strenuously resist it by harking back to the glory of the classical era or displaying national pride. Even in a recent study on Greek crisis and European modernity, it has been claimed that, I quote, in the case of peripheral capitalist societies, like Greece, for instance, tradition and modernity merge as conflictual trends in an antagonistic relationship, end of quote. Such statements confirm that up to now, the narratives about Greece have been dominated by binarisms, West-East modernity, traditionalism, modernization, populism, modernizing and underdog cultures, informed by political developments and promoting westernizing and modernizing trends. All this suggests that the discussion of modernization in Greece has pointed to different forms of engagement with Europe, socioeconomic, dependency theory, political, institutional, Europeanization, or cultural dualism. Departing from this approach, my aim in the book is to produce a more complex and hybrid narrative by focusing on the area of culture and self-understanding. The changing patterns of migration and attitudes to the past, the roller coaster of Euroscepticism, the rehabilitation of those defeated in the Civil War, 1946-1949, the rediscovery of the Balkans following the end of the Cold War, the proliferation of audiences, canons, and past, the growth of social movements, the rise of otherness and increased linguistic diversity, adapt to a more diverse society whose development has to be seen as more complex. As a result, the dominant paradigm of modernization has begun to be questioned, while the practice of equating Europe with modernity began to break down, particularly during the crisis. Despite its revitalization in the 1990s in the form of the democratization of the countries of Eastern Europe, modernization has been challenged from being a neocolonial strategy to force others into an inescapable and not culturally specific track towards development. A critique of philological modernization theories led to the concepts of multiple modernities, varieties of modernity, or the ambivalence of modernity. Postcolonial studies also rejected the normative pattern of modernization modeled on the European example and defending the autochthonous intellectual traditions of non-Western societies. Working with concepts such as glocalization or hybridization to introduce variety and the dynamic perspective into the analysis of the contemporary world, it scrutinized the evolutionary premise of modernity, thus encouraging a move from an normative notion of modernization to perceiving it as a heterogeneous, hybrid, and self-reflexive process. So far, the models used to analyze Greek society have been permeated by theories of dependency, belatedness, or abstinence, as I have said. But gradually, a shift is taking place from a comparative juxtaposition of Greece with Europe, using Western modernity as a yardstick, to a comparative consideration of Greece in post-colonial Orientalist or anti-Western terms. This has involved either exploring its semi- or crypto-colonial status and its role in the Orientalist imaginative process, or focusing on the world of the East Byzantine Orthodoxy to try and articulate Greece's cultural difference vis-a-vis the West. The questioning of the idea of Europe as coextensive with modernity and as a symbol of cultural superiority pointed at the in-betweenness of the Balkans as a manifestation of intra-European Orientalism. and the role of orthodoxy in the new international reality. In a period in which Europeanization and modernization were being promoted, new critical positions towards the West emerged, originating from different intellectual perspectives and challenging Eurocentric theories of adjustment. They marked the transition from conformity with European modernization to the acceptance of notions of cultural difference and otherness. The theory which is in a way prepared this transition and facilitated the shift of emphasis from politics to culture is that of cultural dualism proposed by primarily Nikiforos Diamandouros and others, which has been a popular analytical tool since the 1980s. The metapoliticy has been seen primarily as a political term towards democracy in Europe, but in the long run, it was also a cultural term involving the diversification of Greek society and culture and the rearticulation of collective action and the individual of radical politics and new lifestyles. Democratization, Europeanization, stroke modernization could be considered the two major top-down transitions of the metapoliticy, but a number of other bottom-up transitions took place at a cultural level, which my book aims to explore. These transitions are not teleological, but are marked by ambiguities, complexities, regressions, and uncertainties. Transitions in culture tend to be long-term and not always clearly demarcated, whereas social and political transitions are more easily identifiable without, however, always being one-way processes. For example, in the 1990s, Greece went from being a land of emigration to a country of immigration. Then, with a brain drain due to the crisis, it reverted to its earlier status, notwithstanding transit migration with the new post-2015 wave of refugees and migrants, also looking to leave the country for Western and Northern Europe. Similarly, Europe was treated in the 1970s and 1980s as a source of funding, then as an agent of modernization, and again during the crisis as a provider of rescue funding. Multidirectional transitions and uncertainties about its end suggest that the metapoliticy offers a new way of understanding temporality, abandoning the linear, causal, and homogeneous conception of time, characteristic of earlier regimes of historicity. This is in line with the wider changes in the conception of time, replacing the notion of progress with the notion of crisis. The increased emphasis on contested past since 1974 has undermined any sense of homogeneity in Greek culture and raised questions of identity more intensely than before. The rise of cultural diversity and gender politics also fostered cultural ambiguity and hybridization. But these moves towards diversity and pluralism are not without setbacks. While looking ahead was characteristic of the period, the crisis encouraged a retrospective trend, reviving all divisions, revisiting past events, and cultivating Eurosceptic sentiments, with the affective history of the metapoliticy representing a passage from euphoria to indignation and ultimately to melancholic self-reproach or stoic resignation. The theories of inadequate or belated modernity gave way in the first years of the 21st century to cautious optimism about the achievements of Greece as a modern nation, culminating in the Athens Olympics in 2004. But the crisis reversed the elation of the Olympics and encouraged a pessimistic reading of modern Greek history, focusing on the successive economic crisis. And here I have got in mind Dactylis's book on civil wars, and seven bankruptcies. So a study of the post-Juma period cannot look for inexorable one-way transitions, but is more inclined to see them as somewhat precarious processes. So the question is, what then constitutes the most distinctive feature of the culture of the metapolitics? I would argue that it is the prominent role of identity in various forms resulting from a major shift seen in the period from politics to culture, involving the disentanglement of group identities from political affiliations and the move from a battle for political power to a clash for cultural hegemony. This does not mean that culture has been divested of politics, but some debates and contests have been transferred from the realm of party politics to the broader cultural domain. Now the focus is more likely to be on issues such as identity, otherness, sexuality, heritage, and memory, with socio-political debates being turned into cultural wars. Moreover, the ascendancy of the anthropological and biopolitical conception of culture as a way of life, in contrast to the humanist perception as heritage and spirituality, has promoted the association of culture with identity, and in turn the prominence of identity politics as in other countries. Even the statement by Konstantinos Karamanlis, Greece belongs to the West, or Andreas Papandreou, Greece to the Greeks, are not only political gestures, but also identity proclamations. The growth of tourism, heritage issues such as the Macedonian question, the Parthenon sculptures, membership of the Eurozone, the Olympic Games of 2004, and the financial crisis attracted the attention of the outside world and raised questions about nation branding. The common denominator in the fundamental questions that preoccupied Greeks during the post-Junta period, in other words, the three questions are how the nation is defined, who owns the past, and how the past is remembered, is the quest for identity. The notion of the cultural continuity of the Greek nation was increasingly challenged by scholars who acknowledge the plurality of cultural traditions, ancient, Byzantine, Ottoman, Venetian, and shifted the focus to the invention, construction, and negotiation of the past, in this way contributing to a widening gap between historians and the general public that still held to traditional views. As a result, this critical engagement with the past and its perceived loss of stability, questions were posed about identity more intensely than before. There was also increasing concern about language and identity, with the old language question being superseded by anxieties about the decline of linguistic standards, the introduction of the monotonic system, the invasion of English, Latinization, and teenage slang. While in the past, language has been a less important factor than religion in defining national identity, here to remind you that the exchange of populations between Greece and Turkey was on the basis of religion and not of language or ethnicity. In the post-Junta years, language and national identity became ever more closely entwined. Treating Greek as a monument to be safeguarded, language debates turned into crusades to save or protect Greek, and any threats to the language were perceived as challenges to the national identity. With Greek culture losing its oral character and being rapidly exposed to visual challenges and digital technologies, the deregulation of the Greek media and the importation of foreign TV shows did not simply contribute to cultural pluralism, but they also raised issues of cultural consumption and identity. Fictional stories on television, for instance, made fun of Greek behavioral patterns, prompting introspection, while during the crisis, foreign media contributed to a Greek identity crisis by contrasting Greeks to other Europeans. In the post-Junta period, television and cinema coexisted in a symbiotic and antagonistic relationship, with the former claiming a wider audience and the latter aspiring to transcend the boundaries of national culture by exploring new social issues, engaging with transnational audiences, or deconstructing the image of Greece as a holiday idyll. The thematic shift in contemporary Greek cinema away from the grand narratives of political history, represented primarily by Theo Angelopoulos, to concerns about identity, sexuality, and family dynamics, represented by the Greek weird wave cinema, coincided with similar transitions in social movements. These movements were emancipated from narrow political affiliations by claiming new or autonomous identities, youth and women in particular, while homosexuality began to be perceived as an identity and no longer just as a sexual practice. This fostered yet another transition from a discourse on rights to the disruption of all fixed identities, and queer culture gained invisibility and contributed to growing cultural diversity and changing identity politics. Another sign of the increasing preoccupation with identities has been the emphasis on Greekness and its definition. The politically driven ethnocentrism of the post-Civil War era gave way to a cultural ethnocentrism and debates about the aesthetics of Hellenism or the role of the generation of the 1930s in promoting Greekness. And here I would like to remind you that the essays and diaries of the most prominent representatives of the generation of the 30s were published in collective volumes after 1974 and generated discussion. Starting with political euphoria and ending in an economic debacle, the metapolitics may have become politically synonymous with democratization and reconciliation. Yet culturally, it signifies an age of identities marked by competing narratives. The reformist and forward-looking one of the modernizers, the critically retrospective and melancholically reflective one of the left, reminding the Walter Benjamin's idea of the left-wing melancholia, and then the Western one, harking back to a lost communitarianism of the unorthodox intellectuals. One could claim that if politics helps to divide the period from the junta to the crisis in the faces, culture and identity draw it together, acting as its overarching metaphors. Thank you.
Thank you, Dimitri, very much indeed. To save time, let me go straight to our first discussant, Thalia, please.
Thank you very much, Kevin. I would like to thank the observatory and you personally for inviting me. And I'm happy to be here with the two distinguished speakers. So as mentioned by Kevin, Dimitris Diabas is not new to the topic of cultural impact on Greek political developments and vice versa. He has been interpreting for some time such developments through the lens of cultural dualism and beyond, trying to incorporate in the long-lasting model of dualism the ambivalence and hybridity that characterize Greek modernity. We heard that from Diabas himself. In his new book, he approaches the topic once again, and his aim is to shift away from the political analysis that abound and explore the cultural dynamics which shaped Greek modernity in its trajectory since the Metapolitευση. In his own words that we heard, and this is our in quotes, the Metapolitευση can be described in political terms as an age of democratization and reconciliation, while in cultural terms, it might be defined as the age of identities. Identities thus are the core of his thesis. In the past 25 years or more, In the past 25 years or more, we have witnessed a discursive explosion around the concept of identity. Greatly informed by the movement of social constructionism, it has spanned over a variety of disciplinary areas, which have basically been critical of the notion that there is no such thing as an integral, unified identity. Identities are never unified. And in late modernity, they're increasingly fragmented and fractured, since singular but multiply constructed across different, often intersecting and antagonistic discourses, practices, and positions. The anti-essentialist critique of ethnic, racial, and national conceptions of cultural identity brought about with social constructionism has made us, I believe, realize that we have no longer, we cannot any longer continue thinking the old way. Identities are subject to a radical historicization and are constantly in the process of change and transformation. Thus, the concept of identity is not an essentialist, but a strategic and positional one. It does not single a stable self unfolding without change from beginning to end through all the vicissitudes of history. And the political is ever present within conditions of power, political antagonism, and inequity, rendering thus identities a matter of considerable political significance. I think this is an aspect I'm not sure is sufficiently discussed in the book. Of course, I did not refer to active politics that Giovas is trying to avoid, but to the power relations among individuals and groups, such as the distribution of resources or status. Dimitris Giovas set himself a very ambitious goal, that is to trace and decode the competing narratives of identities in a very wide spectrum of disciplines: history, religion, language, minorities, migration, youth culture, gender, the media, the cinema, and of course, literature, his preferential field. Admirably, there is a lot of richness of information and a lot to reflect about. But as inevitably one cannot be an expert in so many fields, in covering so much diverse material, there are instances where I have felt, if I may say, that the analysis is more descriptive and less interpretative. The topic of identity is at the heart of social psychology. Hence, being a social psychologist, it has been a par excellence area of my research in analyzing the ethnocentrism of the Greek educational system, in working with a Muslim minority in Thrace, and in being involved with the arduous goal of refugee integration. I thus empathize with Giovas' difficult task to having to bring to view the culture in between inhabited by the Greeks who need to negotiate boundaries and multiple fluid identities. At some point, he mentions Homi Baba. Baba was seminal in introducing the notion of hybridity, opposing binary thinking, denoting the ability to straddle competing cultures and negotiate the difference in conditions of antagonism, and each time rearticulate a new entity which is not the sum of its old parts. I would like now to move to another point. In his closing paragraph, Dimitris Giovas mentions the three, in his view, competing narratives at force from the Metapolitics onwards. He mentioned them at some point in his discussion now. So in quotes, competing narratives are the reformist and forward-looking one of the modernizers, the critically retrospective and melancholically reflective one of the left, and third, the anti-Western one, harking back to a lost communitarianism of the neo-Orthodox intellectuals. In line with what I was just postulating, the existing narratives are much more complex, fragmented, and intersecting. But even if we were to think of them as abstractions, I have some doubts whether this typology corresponds to the existing narratives. The reformist modernizers represent indeed a significant political trend having shaped respective identities. But the melancholic, reflective left, these may have been so until the early 80s, but we are far past that stage. The left has had ruling power, has unfortunately disengaged from reflective practices, and remains highly assertive. As for the neo-Orthodox current of thought, it has been and still is very limited and of a very small influence, I believe. If I were to resort to ideal types and yet again to another dualism, which I'm not very fond of, I would say that the competing narratives cutting across the Greek society as well as across the political spectrum consist of the modernizers versus the nationalists. I'm afraid that the ethnocentric, nationalist, xenophobic discourse has been and continues to be dominant as regards cultural identities. I hope I'm not correct. There is no doubt that Greece has made big steps towards economic prosperity and democratization, and these changes have shaped the cultural identities of the modernizers. But what about the unabated opposing discourses? The educational system and school history in particular remain highly ethnocentric. The church, while is as backward as ever, enjoys high trust, and politicians are afraid of opposing its meddling into affairs beyond its jurisdiction because they don't want to bear the cost. The glaring proof was the handling of COVID. The populist reactions towards the name dispute over North Macedonia characterized even those groups and political forces that could be considered to be modernists. Anti-Semitism is among the highest in Europe. The xenophobic discourse against migrants and refugees represents the majority. The assimilation of the historic minorities is the dominant aspiration, equally for the people and the political parties. The unbelievable delays in the construction of the Athens mosques were met with a wide consensus. As regards to gender equality, Greece has one of the lower scores in Europe. Similarly, in the last Eurobarometer, Greeks have the most negative attitude towards Europe compared to all other Europeans. These are examples of cultural identities eloquently brought up in the book. If we were to think in terms of the categorization of the three competing narratives mentioned, in which one would these discourses be nested? I leave that to the discussion. I think it's interesting to pick it up in the discussion. In closing, this undoubtedly ambitious book gives us food for thought and instigates further discussion on cultural identities. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Athalia, very much indeed. We'll pass to Stathis, please.
Hi, everyone. It's a pleasure to be with you and to discuss this book. I'm only sorry I'll have to leave earlier due to another obligation. But I have to say that I read the book with a lot of pleasure. I think few people are able to cover such a broad area of investigation as Dimitris Diovas. And I do agree with him that even though the discussion on the post-1974 period in Greece has been very extensive, it has primarily focused on, I would say, institutional or party politics much more than on culture, and cultural changes have been quite essential in those years. And so trying to understand and capture what those changes have been and what their effects are going to be, I think, is a very important enterprise. I would say this is a book certainly of cultural history, but it's also a book that I would describe as a book of cultural geography in the sense that it tries to map out literally cultural change in a variety of different areas, ranging from attitudes about, say, religion and the national identity, about recent history and public memory and history, to literature, television, even poetry. I would just single out one area which strikes me as extremely central in Greece's culture, which was missing from the book, and that is music. Greeks communicate with each other and understand each other and their identity and culture very much through music, I think. And even though I understand that it's impossible to cover everything, that I would probably single that area as one worth of more attention, perhaps in a future foray into this topic. So the book is very comprehensive otherwise, covers a wide and very broad part of culture, and also has a central thesis which emerges in the conclusion. And the basic thesis is that this period after 1974 has basically seen a gradual but unmistakable transition away from a primarily political understanding of self, of identity, and of nation, to a much more fragmented and much more cultural understanding. So that's the basic thesis of the book. I would say that in general, it's difficult to quarrel with this interpretation, indeed. Following broader trends in developed countries, there is much less of a binary political distinction in which every dimension of life can be aggregated onto a partisan identity, which I would argue was true for the period preceding the dictatorship, but also true for a long period after the transition to democracy, and in the present, in which things are much more fragmented. I would say the The term diversity, which is used quite centrally, could be rendered using the empirical term of fragmentation. There are lots of different understandings and discourses that cannot easily be aggregated into a binary. Even though that is true, that is that should be qualified, obviously, as the book recognizes the reality is far more complex and nuanced depending on which area we're looking at. For example, in politics, as I pointed out, I would say until the 1990s and again later on, political polarization was extremely central, and the ability of political parties to appropriate various issues and connect them to the partisan identities was very effective. It is only in the years preceding the crisis and especially after the crisis that political parties have lost the ability to control public discourse and connect it to their antagonists as effectively as they could in the past. Also, a lot of debates about history and memory have also been much more politicized. This is a book that I appreciated very much as a reader, but I also appear as a sort of actor in various topics, especially the question of, you know, the discussion about recent history and the position and the place of the Greek Civil War in public memory. That was a discourse in which a lot of scholars who participated were very closely aligned with political parties. So I would say it was, you know, I felt that it was very difficult to move the conversation away from present day political objectives. But let me raise four general points about the book, which I think could help the discussion about the role of culture and cultural change. The first one is the point that perhaps the extent to which cultural processes were homogeneous prior to 74 is perhaps overstated, even though there was a lot of, there was a very central role for the state and for political parties. There were lots of different identities, especially identities articulated around, for example, locality, that were extremely important in helping Greeks understand who they are and how they perceive themselves and their relationship vis-a-vis the state, that were, you know, very pronounced. And again, on the flip side of that, I would say that even today, in the age of fragmented cultural identities and diverse understandings of reality, I would argue there is considerable homogeneity, as Thalia pointed out, on a variety of different topics when it comes to how Greeks perceive themselves, the relationship to various institutions, and various traditional understandings of identity. Perhaps the distinction between the past and the present is not as pronounced or as clear-cut as it is today. And certainly the fact that there's been a shift away from politics to culture does not negate the fact that sometimes culture can be mobilized to polarize a population in political terms, as we've seen was happening and it continues to be happening in the United States and some other countries. The Brexit, for example, politics in Britain is a very nice example of how you know, issues of identity and culture can be closely made can be politicized and used in political competition. My second point is that I appreciate very much the idea of problematizing the discussion of cultural dualism that has been so central in various commentators and scholars' attempt to understand Greek identity. But there is a flip side to dualism, this idea that, you know, are Greeks European or are they Oriental? Are they modern or are they ancient? And this is the notion, again, Thalia raised the point of hybridity. I think for a very long time and increasingly so, Greeks have been negotiating, competing, but also competing elements of their own identities, but also trying sometimes very creatively, and I would argue music is the field in which that is very obvious, to negotiate and to connect these varying elements of their culture, to make a culture for themselves that combine international, Western elements and their own traditions in ways that can be sometimes extremely successful. I would emphasize, you know, the example of Greek music in that respect. And I think the same is true about perceptions of identity. I would say the question of the division or the contrast between two competing forces is not necessarily the dominant force in Greek cultural politics. Very often one finds extremely creative and interesting ways of turning this contrast into a force, you know, a combination that attempts to provide and construct a new identity that is made up of those different elements. Which leads me to my next point, which is that there is a difference between perhaps the present and the past. In the past, perhaps 20 or 30 years ago, there was a very clear distinction between Greece's relation to Western modernity. Greece was lagging, Greece was behind. That was a gap that was very difficult to cross. And of course, Greece had to catch up. Whether it was succeeding or not was contested, but certainly there was a sense that there was a very, very big gap. I think there is less as today, and in spite of the crisis, or perhaps because of it, there is less of a sense of an enormous gap between Greece and modernity. And in fact, a lot of the points that the book makes, a lot of the cultural issues that have emerged in Greek discourse, a lot of these processes that the book very eloquently describe are precisely the same issues on which most developed countries are grappling. In fact, I would argue a lot of the debates politically or culturally that Greeks today engage in are very closely matching what is going on in a lot of other countries. And there is a very close echoing of the same issues, which in a sense point out that in its own way, sometimes with lots of back and forths, with obstacles, in fact, Greece has become part of that world and is partaking in these kinds of debates in a way that certainly does not reflect an issue of distance as strongly as in the past. So to summarize my comments, I would say that the book is a very courageous attempt to cover a very broad set of issues and debates. I think it strikes certainly a very convincing note about the direction of a lot of the cultural debates that are going on. But I think there is a lot of room for discussion about exactly how those cultural shifts that have been taking place in Greece are changing the way in which people perceive their identity, the ways in which people perceive the relationship to the institutions of their country, and certainly the way they perceive themselves as part of a world that is changing very rapidly as well. So thank you very much for the opportunity to reflect on those issues.
Thank you, Stathis, very much indeed. I know that you have a time problem with us, but I hope you can stay a little bit longer. Let's give Dimitris the opportunity of responding to the points that both Thalia and Stathis have raised. And Dimitris, I wonder if you could begin with the perhaps more conceptual points that, like you, others disagree with the simplicity, the crudity of dualisms. And you talk of hybridity, but both Thalia and Stavis have questioned the hybridity that you have, whether the fragmentation is as pronounced, or whether you recognize sufficient fragmentation. There's a plethora of different competing narratives. Also, if we're talking in terms of notions of identity, Stathis has raised the question of identity and music, which as an outsider seems to be very strong in the Greek case. So I wonder if you could kick us off more at the level of concept and framework and your references to hybridity and whether you've identified the key elements of change, please.
Yeah, I mean, in the first chapter of the book, I deal with the various manifestations of cultural dualism and how it has been used as an analytical tool. But what I'm trying to do is just acknowledge the usefulness of this different forms of dualism, because there's no one pattern of cultural dualism, but there are different patterns of cultural dualism. But then to see that this pattern breaks down. And that's why I'm proposing the notion of hybridity or hybridization or ambivalence, to see how these different cultures interact. Because so far the emphasis has been on the modernizing culture, but there is nothing about the underdog culture or segmentary society, different concept that they different aspects of the culture of dualism. So what I'm trying to do is just not to offer a new model, but just to challenge the existing model, but using hybridity, which has been used by different theorists, postcolonial theorists, and to see how the opposing forces merge and interact rather than they're there. As a kind of stable forces. So that's my argument, is just to see hybridization on different levels as a way to challenge this cultural dualism.
Thank you. I'd understood Thalia to be encouraging you to go further, and whether your fragmentation was sufficient.
You see, I tried to link that dualism with another aspect, another cultural dualism, the rise of the popular culture, and also how the elitist culture towards the end of the 20th century feels in a way threatened. So I tried to read cultural dualism with another aspect of cultural dualism, so to speak. So it just started to see how these two different conceptions interact and work together.
Okay, thank you. Can I pick up on Stathis's point about pre-1974? And whether identities in Greece were quite as homogenized as you think of. Post-Civil War Greece, yeah, and homogenization.
From the early 19th century onwards, there is a trend towards homogenization, suppression of regional identities. And this was the practice throughout the 20th century. I'm not saying that there was a homogeneous culture, but there was a homogenizing trend, which in a way reaches its peak in 1974. And then with the acknowledgement of different minorities, the migrants and so on, there is an increasing acknowledgement of different cultural traditions, localities, minorities and so on. But before 1974 and throughout the 19th and 20th century, there were certainly anti-homogenizing trends They were certainly minorities, but the trend was to suppress them. That's why the census, the only census that we have got, the last census that we have got mention of languages is in 1951. And this was to show that all the Slavo-Macedonians and all the minorities had been expelled from Greece. So I'm not arguing that there was a homogeneous culture. It was a homogenizing trend and policy by the Greek state.
So there's a difference between the official homogenizing Greek state narrative and what was going on in wider society. Both Thalia and Stathis have alluded to the point about whether Greece is atypical. And certainly, I would know from a wider comparative political science literature, there is much discussion of identity being a key cleavage in most European party systems today. A number of writers have emphasized that it's becoming more and more prominent and challenging traditional left-right notions. So are you saying that the rest of Europe is somehow catching up with an identity angst in Greece, or is it that Greece is simply part of a much wider Brexit, Trump, culture war, Viktor Orban, Poland? Which European country could you point to and not identify currently conflicts, severe systemic conflicts over identity?
Yeah, I mean, what I'm arguing is that Greece is part of this identity politics, which we could find in many European as well as American in America. And so what I'm trying to argue is that if you look at it from a cultural perspective, Greece and the period from Junta to crisis is a period of identities, not just an identity, but competing identities and cultural wars. In this way, Greece comes closer to the identity anxieties and identity politics of other European and Western countries.
If I may...
yes, I wanted to bring you in, and then if I can pass to Stathis and then Thalia for
I wonder why, when we think about identities, we exclude political identities, which were extremely strong in Greece. So people identified primarily with political traditions. They were, say, monarchists or republicans, and that was... you know, these were identities very much, I mean, that were felt very deeply by many people as personal identities and helped people filter out, you know, or in whom, you know, with whom they socialized, whom they appreciated and how they structured their everyday lives. And there are some studies that even show that there was a correlation between political identities and marriage practices and strategies, for example. So why, you know, why assume that these are not identities or lesser identities than the identities that have since been emphasized?
Yeah, I'm not arguing that, just I'm not excluding political identities. That's why I use the identities in plural. But it seems to me that culture was ahead in acknowledging otherness, in bringing up this hidden identities, minorities, migrants, and so on. So in that respect, culture and particularly literature, films, and so on were ahead in highlighting this hidden or suppressed identities.
But aren't you applying a sort of modernization theory in reverse, assuming that some identities are more modern or than others, and therefore there is a sense of linear kind of evolution?
No, not necessarily. But it just what I'm saying is that there were some identities, suppressed identities, which in a way which is associated with otherness, and then these identities, there are certain cultural agents which helped to resurface those identities.
So is the key point here the absence of suppression?
Yeah, or mechanisms, cultural mechanisms for highlighting or bringing to the surface those identities. For example, Greece up to the late 1980s was not considered itself as a Balkan country. So with the end of the Cold War and the Yugoslav War and so on, and the notion of Balkanism and Maria Todorova's book on reimagining Balkans, Greeks started thinking about the Balkans, thinking themselves as a kind of thing in Greece as part of the Balkans. So this is an issue of identity. But here there's a synergy between politics and culture.
Okay.
Politics helps this kind of reimagining of the Balkans. But at the same time, culture also contributes to that.
Can I bring Thalia in? Any responses so far, Thalia? Oh, you're on mute, sorry.
I would like to, Dimitri, to go back to my comment of your typology of the three competing narratives, the modernist one, the left, which is the melancholy of the left, and the neo-Orthodox. I contest that these are the three competing narratives, three major competing narratives. I think that really the melancholy of the left is something that's past and gone, and that the neo-Orthodox is a very, very small trend, hasn't affected so much the Greek culture and the Greek identities. It's a very particular movement, and right now also really withering away. So I was thinking that all these discourses that I mentioned and that you very well describe in your book, that show a very nationalistic, very xenophobic, very racist, sometimes aspect of the Greek identity, where would you place them? In which of the three narratives? I mean, there are so many behaviors and discourses that are very much away, of course, from the modernist trend, but where would they be placed? They do not belong, they cut across, first of all, I think they cut across all these nationalistic and xenophobic and really ethnocentric discourses. They cut across the political parties and they cut across the Greek society. So it's very difficult to place them in specific parties, because you can see them in every party and you can see them everywhere. I mean, to me, if we are going to think in dualisms, I don't like to think in ideal types. I don't like to think in categorizations, because I think identities are much more malleable and much more fluid and much more. They're not structured in a dualist sense. But if we are going to think of a dualist in a dualist way, don't you think that there is a big divide there between the modernizers and the non-modernizers, the nationalists, the xenophobes, the ethnocentrists? I mean, that they are everywhere. And I mean, I really think that maybe this group is even larger than the modernizers, unfortunately. Maybe. It's not part of, this is not something that is a research, you know, a really well-researched thesis, but I have fears that maybe this may be, you know, more than a bigger group than the modernizers.
Okay, Dimitri?
Thank you for your point. It's just that in a way I would include the nationalists and xenophobes together with neo-Orthodox, because they hark back again to some sort of communitarianism and so on. The reason why I didn't mention the nationalists and so on is that because the Neo-Orthodox have developed a particular narrative. And because in the book I'm discussing the views of Jan Arras, they develop a certain narrative. The nationalists is more kind of a reaction and so on, rather than a fully developed narrative. But certainly they can be grouped, all these nationalists within the Orthodox, they can form one group. And this takes me to the other point you raised about the modernizers and the non-modernizers. The one point that I'm making in the book is to look at those non-modernizers. Who are they? And I mentioned in the first chapter a number of names there. Who are these non-modernizers?
Everybody. I mean, the man in the street, I mean, the person who doesn't want to be vaccinated, the person who is shouting against the North Macedonia, the name of the everyday men.
Yes, you're talking about ordinary people, but I'm talking about intellectuals, because for the first time, this kind of the so-called underdog culture or non-modernizing culture has intellectual support by various intellectuals. And what I'm trying to see is whether who are these people, not ordinary people, but the intellectuals, what sort of arguments, what sort of narratives they put forward. The Neo-Orthodox put forward a more coherent narrative rather than the nationalists. The nationalists put forward a reaction rather than a narrative. But I agree with you that they can be grouped together.
But when you talk about the competing narratives, are you really talking about the competing narratives of intellectuals? Because for me, cultural cultural identities is a much broader sense than what intellectuals sort of construct. Because these are more. They're narrower than what cultural identity is, I think.
Dimitri.
Yes, I agree with you, but because the theories, the modernizing theories are put forward by intellectuals, then I need to see, we can identify clearly who is representing the modernizing camp. But then we need to identify who is representing the non-modernizing come. Is it coherent? Do they produce a coherent narrative?
No.
I appreciate that.
Definitely not. It's not a coherent narrative. Definitely not. Yeah.
I appreciate that, Dimitri, but there's a difference between giving a kind of intellectual history of identities, and I'd understood you to be talking about identities in Greece, in the en bloc.
Yeah.
I mean, you just... when we're talking about narratives, we're talking also of models of cultural analysis.
Yes,
applies also to ordinary people or groups of people.
But okay.
What I'm trying to do is just the models of analysis: who is representing whom, and who is standing. And that's why I'm trying to show. Or just to problematize the sense that then this kind of underdog culture or non-modernizing narrative, who is it representing? Is it coherent?
Okay, thanks. I wonder if I can...
not coherent. I agree with you that it's not coherent, yeah.
Thank you both. Can I move to a question which has been sent in by Professor Takis Ioakimidis, who has written extensively on the subject of his question. Today marks the 30th anniversary of the signing of the Treaty on European Union. I would like to ask the panel how it judges the contribution of the European Union to the cultural modernization of Greece. A big question. Can I add to this that I remember some years ago, having a very interesting conversation with Thalia in Athens about Greece and Europe. And she was saying that the relationship is one of self-torture. I remember very well the phrase used, self-torture and angst. It was so good, I went on to use it in print. And Takisu is asking about the contribution of the EU to cultural modernization. But I wonder whether in this respect, a Europeanizing identity could ever be unifying or useful in the Greek context, in the sense that the legacy of the crisis, but also even on a longer term basis, wouldn't we see Greece's journey in Europe as a kind of journey to Ithaca, one that will never fully be realized, and one which would always risk elite intellectual embarrassment when considering the reality of substantive adjustment and convergence. So you pay a lot of attention to Greece and Europe. I know what, and Takis is inviting you to comment about the cultural contribution of Europe to modernization in Greece. And I would simply add Thalia's earlier point that this seems to be one of self-torture, a dynamic which would always be divisive.
Yeah, I mean, raise the question. I have got one whole chapter about relationship to Europe, Europhiles or Eurosceptics. One point that I make is that although we can talk about institutional Europeanization or Europeanization in general, it's difficult to talk about cultural Europeanization. This obviously does not doubt the cultural contribution of Europe, but it's difficult to talk about cultural Europeanization.
Why?
Because it needs a definition of what is the cultural Europeanization.
Some years ago, I looked into the usages across the social sciences of the term Europeanization, and I found some sociologists had referred to it in terms of various cultural habits. A fascinating study of Iceland, the country that Icelandic people have been drinking more wine, and referred to this as being cultural Europeanization. Can't one think of habits of that kind? You referred to René Hirschhorn in your presentation. She wrote a fascinating piece about how Greeks were celebrating birthdays much more rather than name days, that this is what the West does, this is what Europe does, etc. Can't we talk about cultural habits and Europeanization?
Yeah, but then you could talk about not only Europeanization, but Westernization. And that's the thing, is that how you disengage Europeanization from the Westernization. You could see the different attitudes, the changing attitudes towards Europe and Greece, but it's very difficult to identify the cultural impact of Europe, because it's difficult to disentangle that from the culture of West.
And then on another part of the
West and so on.
Okay.
What?
In another part of the book, you talk about dependency. And I wonder whether you could just give us a quick guide on this in terms of the usage of dependency in relation to change in Greece. We easily talk about the United States dominance in the post-war period. We might talk about a dependency on the European Union in the recent past. You refer to Papandreou talking about Greece belongs to the Greeks. Well, I guess in the context of the bailouts, Greece belonged to various finance ministries around various EU member states. How would you use dependency in relation to Europe today?
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to use the dependency. Dependency, obviously, it was was evoking this model of center and periphery, that then Greece is in the periphery and Europe is in the center. And therefore, the periphery is dependent on the center. But now, obviously, it's very difficult to claim that, because when Greece joined, particularly the euro, the idea was that Greece would be part of the center of Europe, or part of the core of Europe. So it's very difficult to apply those terms.
I wonder if you were looking at Greek debt today, it's owned by Europe. Isn't that an element of dependency?
Yeah, I mean, this is the economic dependency. But whether it's a cultural dependency, that's the issue. So okay. I'm not denying economic dependence and so on, but is it a cultural dependence?
Okay, thank you. We have a question from Alia Yawad. Good evening, and thank you for this webinar. I have a question. How did Karamanlis's actions and measures right after the junta impact the process of modernization in Greece? Who impacted the most? I think she means amongst political leaders in the Metropolitan.
Yeah, this is a more political question related to politics and institutions rather than to culture. My emphasis was on the cultural aspect. But obviously, the role of Karamanlis with EU, EEC, EU membership was instrumental. There is no doubt, and it has cultural implications.
Okay. Thank you. We're coming to the end, so I must let Thalia make her final comments on the general theme and focus. And then we'll pass back to Dimitris for the very final word. Thalia, please.
Well, I don't want to make a general comment. I just wanted to comment on Europe again and just come back to your comment of our discussion in the past. I think that Europe always remains an object of fascination and an object of derision at the same time. So it's something which we approach and we avoid. We want to look like Europeans, but we don't want to look like Europeans. So there is this ambivalence. And this is also, I think, depending, of course, on the political periods, this is also exemplified in all the polls. I mean, there was a point when we were so fascinated about Europe. And now, as I mentioned earlier, we are the worst, we have the worst opinion in the last Eurobarometer of Europe. So this is something that really torments us, but it has to do with very many, I think, developments on our cultural identity that go back to antiquity, that go back to our perception of what the Europeans took from Greece. Europe was reinserted from the West back to Greece. So it's a very long story that I think goes further than the Metapolitευση.
Thank you.
It has to do with the general modernization.
Yes, thank you. On the narrow political point, can make the comment that in terms of the Eurobarometer opinion surveys, it shows that when the UK was still a member of the European Union, public support for the European Union was lower in Greece, and that was following the Brexit referendum. Basically, you know you have a problem with Europe if you're more sceptical than the UK, than the Brits. But Dimitri, your final word to you and before we close.
Yeah, I mean, the book, as I said, is the cultural history of Metapolitευση. Obviously, cannot be comprehensive, and obviously, a chapter on music, as I said, could be useful. Perhaps a chapter on education could have been useful. So there is the historical element, which is trying to offer the facts, and this is the descriptive part of the book, as Thalia pointed out. But what I'm trying to do, this vast material, to put it in an interpretive framework. And that's why these three guiding ideas or guiding principles of the book, to organize it and put it together under the modernization as an aspiration, transition as a process, and diversity as an outcome. So this explains the nature of the book, so to speak.
Thank you, Dimitris, and thank you, Thalia. And in its absence, let me thank Stathis Kalivas for joining what I thought was a fascinating discussion. I'm not sure everyone can see, but I see that we've had a number of distinguished guests and a number of very positive comments for each of our speakers. Let me remind you that on the screen now you can see how you can buy this book, and I strongly recommend that you do buy the book. It's an important contribution. Again, my thanks to everyone. Thank you for the questions that have come in, and we look forward to you joining us for the future events of the Hellenic Observatory. You can see that we shift our focus a little to e-governments and technology, something that I'm not entirely comfortable with myself, but we will explore the impact of e-governments on public administration in Greece. And that will be on Tuesday, the 15th of February, UK time at 6 o'clock. Do please join us then. And thank you for this evening. And a special thanks to Dimitris for contributing this book. Good night.
Good night.